Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the past 26 years, representatives from 197 countries have met to tackle the issue of climate change. These meetings are called a Conference of the Parties, or COPs. The most recent meeting, held in Glasgow, ended just last week. Scientists warn us that if the global temperature rises by 1.5 degrees Celsius, our planet and all life will be destroyed. If you have any doubts climate change is real, just look at British Columbia over the past week. Mudslides are causing havoc. The past summer was one of the worst for wildfires. Blue Dot Northumberland is a local chapter of a national group dedicated to educating people about climate change. Faye McFarland is one of its volunteers. She will shed light on COP26 and what it means for us in Northumberland. I'm so pleased to have with me today Faye McFarland, the lead volunteer with the Blue Dot Northumberland chapter. Welcome to Consider This Northumberland.
Thank you very much, Rob. Nice to be here.
Before we get into the weeds, can you tell us very simply, what was this climate change meeting in Glasgow all about? Just give us a big picture.
Well, COP26 was several hundred countries throughout the world meeting under the auspices of the United Nations to come together with as much agreement as they could in so many different aspects of dealing with climate change globally. So representatives were provided from all the governments and industry, environmental organizations, the whole gamut, and sub-meetings were held prior to and during this. And then, of course, the general, you know, assemblies were met at the same time. So different organizations had different criteria, different ways of negotiating and different needs and wants, and ultimately over a period of a couple of weeks, whatever they were able to agree on was agreed upon, and what is yet to be agreed upon, of course, is still out there.
Before we get down too deep, it's my understanding that this is all organized by the United Nations, and they actually hold these general meetings, I think, annually about climate change. What made this year special compared to the other years that the United Nations organized these kinds of meetings?
Well, I guess I could say, special for who? I suppose for Canada, we have our government that has just been elected or re-elected. We have a new minister for the environment and climate change. We have, in the past year in particular, probably the past several years, the entire world has felt the repercussions physically of climate crisis. The floods and the fires and the hurricanes and the tornadoes and on it goes, not only just in Canada, of course, but, you know, throughout Europe and the rising waters from the global, the melting of the ice caps and so on. Also, this meeting is, I think it's the first main meeting post the Trump administration in the United States. And I think there has been a lot of hope that this one was going to be better and more progressive and more successful because of the new government in the United States. So those are some of the things that I think immediately come to mind.
I know too that, for example, the one of the meetings that was held in Paris quite a number of years ago were working very hard to create a treaty that would involve all the nations and all the global community would respond. And then It's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but these meetings in between are sort of maintenance meetings to sort of see how they're doing. Whereas Glasgow, this was another big meeting in terms of trying to set goals and objectives and trying to meet this goal of not increasing the global temperature by 1.5 degrees Celsius. Am I correct in understanding that? Or if I'm not, tell me what I got wrong.
No, well, I mean, that sort of certainly is my understanding. The Paris Accord of 2015, now we're sort of 6 years after that, and we know so much more, we have seen so much more. And so many more sectors are on track now that may not necessarily have been on track. This is maybe the first time that some of these things have been recognized as being problems. For example, the funding of the fossil fuel industry, you know, the recognition that funding by governments of fossil fuel industry, as well as by the private sector and the banks, you know, is a real big problem. So this is sort of one of the first times that everybody has at least acknowledged that or recognized that. Another big issue, of course, is the funding that the developed countries like the United States, basically the global north, has an obligation to assist those countries, basically the global south, in their dealings with climate change adaptation. Because at this point, you know, I think we're not talking about remediation as much as we are talking about adaptation. So the billions of dollars that are being asked by countries like the United States, Canada, Australia, the EU, to contribute to the countries that are suffering the effects of global warming and climate change that they, for the most part, didn't contribute to during the Industrial Revolution.
Canada, one of its roles was to call for a global price on carbon. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that was and why it was significant?
Well, Canada proposed a global price on carbon so that there was a consistency throughout the world that this would be internationally done and respected and contributed to. But really, that's a last resort. There are so many other tools that should be used before you use global carbon pricing. And I mean, we know that we'll always need coal, not coal, but we'll always need gas and oil. And they'll always be needed for certain industries because at this point, you know, you need them. So you can't just completely ban it altogether. But when you can't use carbon sequestration or some of the other methods to deal with reduction of carbon, then you at least have to cap it. And to do that, you have to price it. So, you know, and then the buying and I suppose selling of the carbon caps and trades, that sort of thing. But that's a last resort. But at least if we get the international community to accept that as a tool, hopefully not the first tool, but as a tool, then that's great, you know.
What we're talking about, though, I guess, is if there's a country that is really good with their reduction of their carbon emissions, and there's a certain level, that gap between them being lower than what they expected, then other countries can come by and buy up that extra so that they don't have to reduce as much. And it's sort of a system of trading off, almost like the stock market. You know, somebody's high, somebody's low, and you buy off the difference.
I think that's, you know, certainly how I understand it. I'm not an expert on any of these things for sure, but that's just my general understanding. But I think that the challenge is to use that not as a first resort, as a last resort.
Understood. And also, you mentioned a cap on oil and gas sector emissions. I mean, obviously, that's a big deal to Canada, and I know they signed on to this. Mm-hmm. That's going to have some very real repercussions, especially out west. Why is this a good thing for Canada to be signing on to this and putting those caps on the oil and gas sector?
Well, first of all, you know, we would like to be, not first of all, but one of the things is we like to be seen as you know, the true North, clean and free. And we like to see ourselves as leaders in the environment and protecting the environment. But clearly we aren't. Clearly we have to do so much more. And it's, you know, we do a little and then it's too late. There's a tremendous opportunity in Canada to transition away from the oil and gas industry as much as is possible. And the jobs that will be transitioning, there's a tremendous opportunity for the education and training and retraining for those people who are skilled and some of them highly skilled in other professions and other trades, other jobs. So that's something that our government has to commit to. Also, you know, it's very clear, and we all know this, every government, the people, the industry, everybody knows that we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. But in Canada, we're a fossil fuel economy, and it's a very big industry. So the challenge is to do a just transition of that over time, but get on it now. You know, get on it right now. And one of the things that we've been talking about is divesting not only our public funds, but also private funds, banks divesting from their investments into the gas and oil industry. And because some of these industries are actually looking at other avenues to generate energy, you know, Shell, for example. There are these days many more investments to be had that are safe, secure, pay decent dividends than the gas and oil industry.
I know that your group held a day of action on October 29th in front of Victoria Hall. Can you tell us about that day of action and what happened?
Well, yeah, sure. The Canadian banks are being asked to divest from fossil fuels. Canadian banks are in the top 25 of all the banks in the world who are investing heavily in the fossil fuel industry. For an example, you know, how bad is it? Well, RBC Capital Markets ranks fifth globally in fossil fuel financing. They generated fossil fuel fees of $454.5 million. In the top 25 banks globally that are financing fossil fuels, RBC, Scotiabank, TD, BMO, and CIBC are in that top 25. So we're looking at something like $800 billion. Our banks in Canada have been investing in fossil fuels since the Paris Accord in 2015.
That's an issue for your group. What would you expect listeners to do about it?
Well, the protest was to let our bank managers and the bank staff know that this was happening, because a lot of times they don't even know that this is what's happening. But we also have a message to people who use those banks, which is basically all of us. And what we're saying is, consider very strongly divesting your RSPs, TFSAs, your RIFs from the fossil fuel industry. So in other words, divest from Enbridge, from TransCanada Pipelines, from CNRL, from Cenovus. You know, this is not where you want your investments to be. This is not what we want our banks to invest in either, because this is continuing the fossil fuel industry. And they themselves are not being as accurate as they should be on the risk that they are taking with ultimately what are going to be stranded assets. You know, when the fossil fuel industry is going to be is going to be devalued as time goes on.
Buffet, that's a big ask to make of people. I mean, this, you're talking about plans that are for people's financial security in the future. What's the rationale that would motivate me to do that?
Well, I've done it. I have divested from my RSPs and my TFSAs my significant amount of money invested into Enbridge and TransCanada pipelines. And because I don't want to be funding fossil fuels, because I know that they are responsible for the degradation of our environment. And I know that I can invest in other investments that are just as good, that give decent dividends. Now, I wouldn't be able to say that maybe 5 or 10 years ago. I've had this discussion with my financial advisor. And, you know, and there are good investments to be had. This, and if you want to invest in green energy, that's fine. But if you want to invest in something else completely, that's fine too. But, you know, but it's doable. And I'm just urging everybody to do that.
You appreciate, though, I mean, kudos to you for doing that and living by your principles. But at what scale would this have to happen to have enough of an impact that banks and investment brokers would take it seriously and actually make systemic change?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I can tell you just the little protests that we had last month resulted in significant action by the bank managers locally in Cobourg and Port Hope, and also from these banks. I mean, the day before that protest, the RBC had a huge page in the Toronto Star trying to defend, not so much that they are investing in fossil fuels, but trying to tell everybody what they also do, the other investments that they make. So, I would think that if people go to the bank and say, you know, I want to sell these investments, or go to RBC, Dominion Securities, or whoever you use, and say, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, the more people that do that, the better the message.
You said earlier that the local bank managers reacted. Can you be a little bit more specific and say what they did and how they reacted? Give us a concrete examples.
Yeah, well, the RBC said, let's meet, you know, would you like to meet? And we said, yes, you know, a few of us would definitely like to. I mean, we're your clients, you know, we have our funds in your bank. Sure, we'd like to meet with you. Some of them said that they will get a statement. We went to TD and also CIBC, that they will get a statement from their head office and provide it to us. And they have. So, you know, I mean, they're prepared to listen, particularly when, you know, we bank there.
Many are saying that there is not enough sufficient action taking place to meet the targets of limiting global temperatures to a rise of under 1.5 degrees Celsius by the target dates. And in fact, I think there were two reports released during the conference that pointed out that if everybody just stays on the track that they are now, it's going to go up by 2.7 degrees by their deadlines. What has to happen, do you think, on a local level?
That's a great question, because there's so much we can do locally that we don't even think about. That, and people feel hopeless and feel that, you know, well, what, you know, how can I make a difference? But locally, there's a number of things that we can do. One example is to divest your investments out of the gas and oil industry and the coal industry, for that one. But also your next vehicle, you know, so many people now, their next car is going to be a hybrid or an e-vehicle. And when we take a look at the targets, we're looking at 30% of all vehicles being e-vehicles by 2030, and 100% being e-vehicles, I don't know, maybe that's hybrid as well, by 2040. So, I mean, that will be a great help. Locally, we can ask our municipal governments to put in electric charging stations. In fact, there's grants available for electric charging stations so that people don't have to worry about charging, you know, between their homes and where they're going. Planting trees. We have so many opportunities for free or very low cost trees through our conservation authority and our municipalities. Don't cut down trees. We need that carbon sequestration. That's one of the nature's ways of cleaning the air. And also, if you're talking about a new furnace or building a new home, consider heat pumps instead of, you know, gas. And of course, lots of people are getting away from oil anyway, but consider heat pumps as opposed to gas or propane. Things like, you know, reducing or eliminating meat from your diet, because the methane gas that is produced, you know, is certainly part of the problem. And methane is even worse because it lasts longer. Think about, talk about, act about things that you do and your lifestyle that pollute. Fire burning, you know, burning your fires. Having motorboats and Sea-Doos and snowmobiles and motorcycles and big trucks and ATVs and ORVs, all these gas guzzlers, you know, do we really need to pollute our air and the trees and the animals, those types of things? Maybe we should be looking at entertainment and recreation that isn't gas dependent and that makes us healthier people as well. So these are the, you know, it's an attitude thing. And it kind of has to come out of the closet more. Being environmentally aware and sensitive has to come out of the closet, because we've been so ensconced, our generation, you know, the post-war baby boomers have been so involved with, you know, gas guzzling entertainment and to our detriment. And, you know, we have to tell our children, but more particularly our grandchildren, because we're not going to be around when, you know, when it hits the fan. And, you know, our legacy is something that we're starting right now. And I just think that that legacy has to be for our children and grandchildren, that we didn't contribute to it when we knew it was so bad and we tried to make it better.
What happened in Glasgow that was at all positive?
Well, there were a lot of things that happened, I guess, that were positive. You know, Canada is one of 30 countries that signed the statement of ending new direct public support or financing for a fossil fuel sector, you know, by 2022, except and under very limited and clearly defined circumstances consistent with 1.5 degrees and the Paris Accord. We prioritize support fully towards clean energy transition. It's the first time we publicly, public financing of the gas and oil industry is recognized as a problem. And, you know, once the public stops financing the gas and oil industry, you know, hopefully the private investors will follow suit. I'm stopping the investment in coal power. I'm stopping using coal by 2040 and ending the export of coal by 2030. I hope I have those dates right. I'm committing $1 billion to help countries wean off coal. You know, there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of positive results from COP26. Further accelerating the decarbonization plans for stronger emission reduction targets for 2030. We moved that up 3 years from 2022 instead of 2025. The developing countries like Canada is providing more money to the developing countries. Reducing global greenhouse gas emissions by 45%. By 2030, that was recognized. So, you know, those are all achievements that we need to be proud of. But, you know, this is nothing to blow our horns about, because it's still too little and it's still too late. So, you know, we can do better and we have to do better.
Faye McFarland, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking me.
That was Faye McFarland, lead volunteer for Blue Dot Northumberland, a local climate action group. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more from Consider This.